We do usually say at least say our names. We don't go into who we are. It's not like a pitch.
No. I'd
say that again.
What?
Yeah, like our names.
You know, I agree. You've been smoking weed.
You out of your mind.
You suddenly look really stoned.
I feel so. 1, 2, 3, go.
Welcome to the first and hopefully the last lockdown edition of Pipe and Slip Mats. This is Volume 5. Tune, right? Great tune to start the show. DJ H featuring Steffi, Think About, from 1990, I believe. If you were train spotting a bit, I think there's some Debbie Harry in there. There's definitely some.
Is that Debbie Harry?
There's Aretha in there. Aretha's the one that comes through more, but there's a bit of Debbie Harry in there.
It sounded like Nina Cherry, the vocal. It reminded me of
does
that.
It does a bit.
It also, and I love it, but it's sort of all, and I think a lot of that piano house of that, it borders on cheesy. And
totally.
I don't mean that rudely, because I bloody love the record.
It's pretty cheesy.
It is
pretty
cheesy.
When I say borders on, it's deep in cheese. But is that, tell me more about that era. Was that Rimini? Was that?
It was sort of pre-Rimini. So Rimini was probably a bit later, more 92-ish.
Right.
So that was more, it was very northern sound, and I'm sure you could back me up on this. You know, it's the sort of thing you'd hear in Blackburn, in Liverpool, up north, and it was part of that whole wave of Italian piano house at the time. So you had Black Box, you had Ginny, Keep Warm, there's another one called Thirst, The Enemy Within. There was a whole bunch of really great actually music coming out of Italy, and for me this is the quintessential Italian piano house tune.
Absolutely. I mean, I used to go to a place called Wigan Pier back in the days, which was, I think it was known for Northern Soul,
the
15, 20 years before that, and then it became sort of like that sort of music, like a rave place. But there was a song by Sister Sledge, it was like a DMC remix, which used to go off, it used to play like this, the DJ H track, and then the last song that always played would be We Are Family, the DMC remix.
So it'd almost be the following, or the closer.
Yeah, it was almost like a rave stroke. Being at a wedding.
You got to play that.
I like the sound of a rave strip being
guys,
at a wedding.
Guys, have we lost the plot? Are we just a bunch of wedding DJ aficionados?
I think I always have been.
I want to hear your rave wedding crossover, please.
Forget about the big wedding era.
So what are we listening to, Tunde?
We are listening to Sister Sledge, We Are Family, DMC remix by Steve Anderson.
Play it.
Sunday, I'm absolutely loving the wedding house vibes.
It's a vibe, isn't it?
Yeah, it's totally a vibe. I mean, I would come to a wedding that you're DJing at. What other big sort of wedding house crossover tracks would you think you'd pull out the bag?
Ooh, I mean,
I always find Last Night a DJ Saved My Life goes down well.
I mean, that's a crossover because it crosses between house and hip hop.
Yeah.
So that works. I think, Actually, maybe a few hip house tracks.
Like
Doug Lazy.
Yes.
At a wedding.
Absolutely.
Get the old boys doing a bit of breaking. And do you know what one what probably goes off nowadays is Felix, Don't You Want Me.
Felix, Don't You Want Me is an awesome track. Yeah. I love it. Yeah, yeah.
But that is, what is it, like 30 years old now? So that is definitely a wedding song.
At least. So there you go, Pipe and Slipmats bringing you the Wedding House vibes.
So we've had two tracks already. It's probably time to do an intro. Welcome to Pipe and Slipmats, the podcast for aging ravers. So I'm Scott.
Okay, not the best intro. I'm James.
I am at Sunday.
We've been doing this a while, haven't we? As in it's 10 years. How many episodes, Scott?
Yeah, this is episode 5. Okay. Just to paint a picture for the listeners, we are sat in Tunde's lovely studio in Notting Hill. We did try to do this last year, didn't we? We tried to do an early lockdown version, all recording from home, but it didn't work so well.
I tell you what I recall, Scott. I recall like being cramped up in this tiny like room with all the doors shut, making sure no sound would get in. But obviously, Tunde is a world-class music producer, a master of audio, so I assumed everything would be fine. I mean, it was very muffled when we were recording. Do you recall?
Yeah, but he said, don't worry, everything will be fine.
It was fine. But it was just someone's dog.
Yeah, well, there was a dog.
I don't own a dog.
There was a dog barking near my house, I grant you that. But at the same time, it didn't feel like you had full mastery of the app that you only downloaded an hour before.
Listen. It was a hit when it left the room.
the annoying thing is, I think we had quite a good show in the can there.
It was amazing.
People talk about like the lost tapes of the Beatles, don't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, very similar. Yeah,
historically, yeah. Culturally, so
this will turn up an Antiques Roadshow. I'm recording from last yeah. year in 50 years' time.
I think it was likening COVID to a Velvet Underground song or something like that. It was quite deep.
God, you're right. Yeah, do you know what? I think we were really struggling. That was about a year and a bit ago, and we were like, let's do another one. I mean, any avid listener, and I can't believe there are many, but any avid listener would recognise we are nothing but, I'd say, sporadic in our output. They won't be massively surprised that we're 18 months on.
No, but to be fair, I mean, a lot of people tried to do live broadcasts last year, and there was a lot of DJs doing live broadcasts this year, and some, let's be honest, were better than others. Some really good ones, actually. I mean, Carl Cox in his, what was it, his rave shed, or whatever he called it, in Melbourne, I thought was excellent.
Cabin Fever, wasn't
was
it?
Was that? Yeah, that was right.
That was great.
Cabin Fever. And then, of course, you know, Defected James, Your Baby. I don't know, you're say welcome. Something about that?
It went much bigger and better than we could ever have imagined. It was only because people needed it back then, because no one knew what was going on at that point, let alone going out. We didn't know what was going on. We needed a reason to have a beer at Friday at 4 o'clock. That's why it went well.
Do you know Trevor Sinclair said it was the health service and Defected that saved Britain?
Really?
Honestly.
So you saved Britain, Joe. They should, yeah. I mean,
nurses and Defected.
Some sort of statue or at least a CBE in the
At least clap sure. for you.
I mean, an MBE.
Should we
for
clap
me would
for
be...
James?
I think if you do clap for me, I prefer a Friday night clap than a Thursday.
And there was some, I mean, there was some good, you know, home DJing setups. There was a few that were particularly good. Like we've mentioned Carl Cox, we mentioned Defected. And the Bob Sinclair, if you called it Bob Sinclair, brilliant house DJ, quite an eccentric character. His sort of sat on the fence for me. On the one hand, the music was fantastic. On the other hand, it was clearly shot in his home studio. And there was so much stuff, as in just stuff on shelves in the studio. It really distracted me because all I wanted to do was give it a big tidy up.
That's your Maria Kondo coming out, Scott, because personally, the paraphernalia around Bob was, I thought, what made it the absolute randomness. And I'll tell you what I would say about Bob, we worked with a lot, or someone like Carl Cox, who's, I mean, quite literally a legend, or people like Calvin Harris, those names are about as big as it gets. And do you know what? They're the ones who grafted in that time. And there were a whole bunch of others who weren't even close to their stature and scale who didn't. And I gave such credit to the fact that they probably didn't need to. Commercially, they're huge. They've got an awful lot lined up. And they kept working week in. Obviously, Clark did like 30, 40, 50 shows.
Did he really?
And grew an audience over that time and socially became bigger and bigger. And I just think that is a fantastic example.
There was a saying which was, if you couldn't get your hustle on in 2020, then maybe the hustle wasn't in you. And I think that's so true. I think people who had the hustle had probably one of the best years of their lives in weird ways, whether they were DJs and they actually was like, I haven't not had time to produce, so I've gone in and just made a bunch of records, and they've probably got like 20, 30, 40, 50 records ready to come out in the next 18 months.
I like that, Tilly. Every day I'm hustling.
Yeah. It kind of brought out the Kevin MacLeod in me. I just quite liked seeing in their houses, to be honest.
Right.
I don't know whether that takes some of the mystique away of these superstar DJs, is kind of, you know, checking out the sort of the shade of their of the paint curtains they have on their walls. Mm. You know, maybe the fact that I'm doing that shows that perhaps they weren't playing the best tunes.
You know,
they could have
been. Think it says more about you than the absolute blind of a set one of those DJs is playing. Yeah. You're comparing it to Grand Design. you've been watching too much More Four. This podcast is Pipe and Slip Mats. It's quite literally for aging ravers. You're it.
Exactly. I sometimes just turn the sound down on Kevin MacLeod, play some Prodigy, and check out.
What else has been going on, Scott, in this time, in this ridiculously long time? I mean, our level.
Other stuff that went on last year. So our good friend Sarah Story, who was a DJ on Capital FM, has just announced that she's got the Annie Mac Friday slot, I believe. So she's listening, big up Sarah Story. Looking forward to hearing you. I think from September she's doing that Friday slot. I actually heard her play last New Year's Day. She played a great mix on Radio 1, which had this brilliant old-school section. So I was thinking, in keeping with the sort of Italian theme, we start with an Italian house track. She played another great Italian house track from the same era, I think 1991, which was an awesome year for music. And I think perhaps we should play that right now. It's called Electric Shock, Shock the Beat.
Let's hear it.
Enjoyed that.
That was great, wasn't it? That whole piano sound, like I said before, really reminds me of Northern clubbing. obviously it was massive. In I only went to Quadrant Park once, but
so
I remember,
jealous.
Yeah, huge.
Annoyingly, because I'm a bit younger, all I know of Quadrant Park is that amazing video that almost became viral and a meme of Quadrant Park. How good was it? Go on, explain.
I mean, it was good, provided you managed to stay on the dance floor. What you didn't want to do is drink too much fluid and need to go to the loo, because it was a pretty sketchy club, actually. It was pretty dodgy. And I heard all sorts of, didn't happen to me, but the stories of people being mugged at knife point in the car park and so on. But the energy in that room, it's quite a small room, was incredible.
Because of the fear factor.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, it was difficult for me to go with my accent.
Because of the Mancunian versus
Liverpool, yeah.
Yeah.
So you weren't allowed anywhere near, or did you put on a Scouse accent?
No, you just was a mute. You'd go to the bar and point at the beer and go, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, I mean, that scene must have been full of incredibly, let's be honest, I'm going to describe them as edgy places that created a good energy, as Scott, you've just said. Like, there must have been some pretty sketchy clubs.
I mean, there was tons of sketchy clubs, and that was part of the fun. That was part of the danger. The edge of the whole thing was that, you know, at any given point, you know, you might be, you know, dancing around next to a stranger and chatting away to them, but, you know, the same person might be the next day the sort of bloke that'd be breaking into your car. It was just, I mean, I met some really, really interesting and slightly odd criminals over the years. So there was a guy, I remember actually, there was a guy who used to, I got chatting to, his name is Wags. Wags, if you're listening, hello, mate. He used to drill open phone boxes. So he had a sort of tool that showed him where on a phone box to drill. And if you put a drill through it, it would empty the coin holder in the phone box. And I met him at Dance Planet at the Aston Villa Leisure Centre.
Wow.
Which is as uninspiring and awful and grim venue as you could possibly imagine. And Wags and I got chatting in a VIP room, and he was like, what do you do? And I told him what I did, and I said, what do you do? And then he outlined exactly what he did for a living, which was just drive around stealing from phone boxes.
But when you say, I mean, was it like a DeWalt, like proper drill, like, or was he concealing it in a kind of subtle manner?
You know what? I didn't get into sort of brand names of drills, but I mean, he seemed to know his stuff,
totally.
Shall we say. He started sending me tapes, actually. I gave him, for some reason, I gave him my address. No, he started sending me mixtapes and calling the house, and that's when I had to start blanking them, you know, because...
There's a couple of bits there. I mean, one bit that felt like an oxymoron. You described the Aston Villa Leisure Centre, and then you said the words VIP room. Take us through that.
Those were in the days before I could get into a VIP room. If it had a VIP room, I'd be very, very surprised.
Right.
I mean, there was still like wall bars and you know, sort of gym equipment lying around. It was nowhere near VIP. But I met other weird sort of criminal people. There was a guy that used to steal wooden pallets. You know these wooden pallets you sort of see lying around because people have delivered stuff?
Yeah.
And he had a system called, called Piss Pit. It's an acronym. Pallets I see, pallets I take.
What?
So he would literally drive around in a van looking for wooden pallets, nick them, and then, I guess, sell them for people that wanted to buy wood.
So many questions. I don't know if it's for now, but the system that you've described, what, that was a self-named... That was his system, or well-known system?
No, I think it was something that he'd made up.
Yeah,
but, I mean, I don't know. I wasn't in that world, so, you know, it could be well-known in the underworld.
Well,
but...
I mean, listeners, if you are aware of the piss pit wooden pallet system of delivery/theft... Do write into the show.
But I mean, again, great guy.
Was he?
Really knew his music, you know.
Did he?
We had a nice chat. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Did he
yeah.
send you tapes?
No, he didn't send me tapes. No, no.
Wish he had.
I know. They would have been good.
We touched upon their VIP rooms because of the lack of one in Aston Villa's Leisure Centre. At some of them sketchier venues, they must have been a joke. Like, did they say, was it like a partially poorly daubed VIP above a door?
I mean, it depends how sketchy the venues were. Did you use CS quite a bit?
Yeah, I got the Hacienda, I got CS.
Hacienda, yeah. That and the door being rushed with people with firearms.
Lovely time. So I just want to know a bit more about, Scott, you know, you spent then a lot of your sort of post-rave career in the clubbing scene when it all, and eventually it became super clubs. Was there a middle ground where it became like down and dirty raves, but then people were like, hold on, we can make a bit of dough out of this and we can show off a bit. What was the middle ground? Was it VIP rooms everywhere, but they were actually all a bit crap and you sat on a barrel in the corner?
I guess for me, it jumped quite quickly from the hardcore that Slipmat and Cy were describing straight into more what was called kind of cool clubbing, where people were wearing Duffer and John Richmond, and we were going to Venus in Nottingham, we were going to Back to Basics. So I guess there wasn't really a middle ground. It went from kind of, yeah, banging hardcore to quite trendy stuff. But in terms of VIP room, you got to remember, I didn't get into VIP rooms until I had a job that could get me into VIP rooms. Back in the day, I was just, I was a punter like everyone else. But once I did get into VIP rooms, you very quickly realised that there was a sliding scale. And at the very top, there was these kind of Dionysian temples of pleasure, but usually in the US clubs, actually, quite often when I went to Miami Mental Music Conference, they were beautiful and drinks were free and the people looked great and it was comfy. And then you'd end up reviewing, I don't know, when I worked for Mixbag, I'd end up reviewing like a club on a boat on a Wednesday night in Bristol, and the VIP room would literally just be a trestle table with some warm beer and the club owner going, oh, you should have been here last week, it was brilliant, you know. Graham Park was just, you know, just giving everyone everything and we were having a great time, and I'd be looking around thinking, so it's just me and you and those sort of weird looking people dancing.
Take you back to Miami. Is that the Thekla?
Yeah, it's the Thekla. It wasn't the best club I've ever been to.
I think as a DJ, well, I wanted to be DJ, it was like the only VIP was the DJ box.
That was the ultimate VIP.
Terry Farley speaks very well of that still now, when he still, not resents, but rails against DJs on stages, and he always talks about, that was never the point. It wasn't the point to be some sort of icon in front. You were meant to be effectively on the side and in the booth and
soundtracking
the people's lives.
We always said that music was about, it was about the experience you had with your friends, rather than looking, if you went to watch a concert with some Michael Jackson or Prince of Pop Star, it was like a group of people watching someone on stage. Rave was about you and your friends enjoying yourselves, and the music, the DJ was there to help you enjoy yourselves, same as the drugs, but it was more about being an inclusive thing. It's like when you think about those days, you think about the music, but you also think about the relationships you had with your friends there, and the guy who was puking up, the guy who was the one with the glow sticks on top of the speakers raving. It's not necessarily about what the DJ was wearing or him clapping his hands. I think that's changed a little bit now, probably to the detriment.
Yeah, but even in my work now, we repeat something that Honey Dijon says, which is dance floors unite people in a way that government and religion never could. And it's like
absolutely,
that, more than anything else, is such a lovely thought to stand by. Should we play a record on that note, Scott?
Absolutely, yeah. So we've done quite a lot of piano stuff. I thought we might switch it a little bit and move down the kind of prog house route, still keeping it well within our era. So this is from about 1992. This is D.O.P. with Groovy Beat. So that was D.O.P. Groovy B. Love. It was on Gorilla Records, which was probably my favourite record label of 1992. First prog house label, really. They had a whole bunch of other great tunes on there. They had Reactor Rhythm, Intoxication. They had Dr. Atomic, Shoodle Floss. They had a whole bunch of stuff. It was founded by Willem Orbit, I believe. And it was like we were talking about earlier, it was just at that edge of the rave era for me, where I'd moving away from hardcore and moving to what you might call more sort of trendy clubs, which had still had that pumping sort of edge dance music, but not so hardcore.
We might have touched on this before. First progressive house record.
Left field, not forgotten. Yeah, for me, I think.
Describe it again to newbies, new listeners. Why is that representative of prog house? Is it the more of the edge and the dark side that it gives?
It's quite dark. It's heavy on the drums. It's slower, certainly, than all the hardcore that was around at that time. Quite reverby. There's almost like a sort of reggae-ish thing going on in it as well. And it's an amazing record. And this was very much of that time as well. D.O.P. Groovy Beat was very much of that time. So, love Gorilla Records. If you don't know them, you should check them out.
I still don't know what prog house is, to be honest.
You don't?
No.
Well, it's different now.
I've got Scooby.
Prog house now is very different to prog house back then.
Yeah. I suppose, I don't know, maybe it's because I wasn't into it. I know Sasha and Digweed did a lot of prog house.
Yeah, theirs was the most swoopy, epic
that?
Stuff.
What was that, Renaissance? That was prog house.
Renaissance album. Well, it was a mix of stuff. I mean, it had Bomb Scare on there, so it wasn't a fully prog house album by any stretch.
Never sort of got to grips
with it. But is that more of a general not caring? But I don't mean not loving, but not needing to care about all the sub-genres, because if it worked for you, or if it's a song you wanted, or if it's a style that you wanted to base something on, or if it was a reference creatively that you wanted to make, in other words, it was irrelevant what version of it was. Does that make sense?
Yeah, probably. And also, I think, like, listening to that record, I get why you like, but it doesn't touch me. I'm thinking back now, why doesn't it touch me? I think it's because it's got no bass in there. There's no real sub.
Really?
Yeah. It's the beat's kind of cool, but it's like having salt with no vinegar. Do you know what I mean? I think, like, if you go back to, say, Bomb Scare, or all those songs have all got bottom ends, from hip-hop to reggae, it's all got the both sides, the beat, the drums and the bass.
Interesting.
Maybe that's what I'll lean to.
That brings us quite nicely on to a new section for Pipe and Slip Mats, which is Name That Tune. So the idea here is that each of us is going to choose a tune, play it to the other two, and you've got to guess what it is. So
can I just say, I love the way Scott builds that, like it's a format that's never been heard. He's like, so new section.
Do I need to explain it again?
Probably not. I mean, Name That Tune is like a 60-year-old, readily understood, a ubiquitous format in any medium.
Does the winner get a prize?
Yeah, big hug.
Also, we've definitely
big COVID
done
hug.
Big COVIDy hug. Yeah.
Okay, but I mean, yeah.
Let's not use this bit. I suppose the only caveat is don't make it ridiculously hard, and obviously it has to be good.
Well, I think this is really annoying because you two will get mine, and I'm not going to get yours. But anyway, I always play the studio, but this is fine. Who's going first? I think Tunde should go first.
Okay.
It's his studio.
Right, you'll probably get the artist name.
I bet I don't.
But you need to get the song title.
For the point and the non-reward.
Okay. And I'm not going to play it from the start, I'm going to play it from halfway through as well.
Bloody hell, mate.
I mean, you know.
Hey. Hey. Spell it out, 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 spell it
fire, my cover to take over. And when we hold the fire, my cause they act like fire. And I boom, boom, case, and they be murder. If I say you, my fire, my center. We say anyway, we don't be at your farm, Babylon. And we tap my buffalo like this and that. And we keep on running, and we keep on.
Shall I go first?
Yeah.
I don't know. And I'm not even close. Is it anywhere close to the Ragga Twins?
Well, it's close to the Ragga Twins because it's got a bit of Ragga in there, but no.
Okay, thank you. Have a great night.
I mean, I liked it, by the way. I have absolutely no idea. Can I just say, you know the bit when I said, don't make it ridiculously hard? Are you telling me that was a fairly well-known tune in the rave?
Would everyone listening be like, oh, you idiot?
Can I just say, to all the people in Manchester, I mean, the person in Manchester who's listening, everyone knows this.
Oh no.
So Genocide 2.
Big in Manchester.
No, it's big everywhere. Genocide 2, Narrow Minds.
To be fair, that was a big track.
Yeah. That was a bit where like you'd be at the bar, you listen, you let go until it broke down to that, so the ragga bit came in, and you'd be running to find your friends with the drinks, filling the drinks ready to go, eh? Lord, eh?
Yeah, great choice, actually, Tunde. That was really good. Should have got that.
Obscure?
It's not that obscure.
It's actually
mate.
Not that obscure. Right. Man.
Without further ado, it's time to start running!
I guess the giveaway for, and it's unlikely, but if anyone ever heard the first ever episode of Python Slip Mats, that was the intro.
It was, yeah.
So, Scott, obviously you know it.
I don't know what it is. I know it was the intro of Python Slip Mats, but I don't know what it is.
Tundi, could you tell the audience your guess off air? The first guess, be honest.
Well, it's just the start of it, because the first words sounds a little bit the start of... Yeah.
Famous rock and roll band
Primal Scream. Is it some scientist?
No, it's very close. It's definitely of that ilk.
Is it Kicking Records though?
Yes.
Yeah, it is.
Kicking Records.
Yeah.
Scott,
I honestly never thought I'd do so badly at a game that I thought we should play, but no, I've got no idea.
It's the Messiah, Temple of Dreams.
Oh god, of course it is.
So I get a point for saying it was on Kicking Records.
You do, and I also like their logo. Yeah.
Okay, my turn. Ready?
Okay.
Creative Generator.
Yeah, got it in one. And what a massive tune that is. Yeah.
Did that not become, like, utterly huge as well?
Well, it was big when it came out. It was Toxic 2, Rave Generator. I'm thinking about 92, 91, around about that time. But, yeah, huge
proper
tune at the time.
Crossover, cut through.
Yeah, it doesn't get played much these days, but, yeah.
I don't think we've played it.
No, we haven't. No,
we have now.
Yeah.
Which is surprising for us. We repeat most of our Scott, thank you for revealing this incredible new format to the world. I mean, I'm surprised. This will probably be a franchise now. Like, license this one out, mate.
Yeah, I mean, people would be like, "How did you even come up with this?"
Name that what old tune? That's so smart.
So, continuing our series of interviewing dance music legends who have created some really awesome tracks and have basically made us who we are, and we're really proud to have in the studio Slipmat, who. His output, I mean, there's at least three tracks that he's produced that sit collectively in our top tens. So, over to you, Slipmat. Matt, thanks very much for taking the time. I guess the first question really is there, and I know this is a tricky one, is there a singular moment that really sums up those early days of rave and hardcore for you? Is there one memory that really sticks with you?
I mean, there's so many, and obviously I've forgotten a lot of it as well. It's a long time ago, but there's bits and pieces. I can sort of visualise back in my mind, sort of thing, being on stage at Rain Dance in front of all those people down there at Jenkins Lane back in the day, which was, you know.
Go on, tell us more about that. How big was that?
A major part of sort of unique history that will never. You know, it's never happened before, and it probably never happened again in the same way because of the sort of culture and how new it was and everything. Some of them times down at Jenkins Lane are really sort of special to sort of think back at. And then you know, you've got the real underground clubs like Telepathy. I remember playing Telepathy in East London, and they had one of them. I can't remember what they're called. What's their, like, the sphere thing with the... the electric that goes out to it.
Like the orb.
Yeah.
And they had one of them in front of the decks. So you had all the puppets coming up and sort of touching it and stuff and that, and then we'd be sort of touching it. Like a lightning strike for the finger.
And did you have a favourite?
There's tons. I've been in the game for so long. There's tons of great memories. That I'm so grateful for.
Matt, did you have a favourite place to play? Again, it must be hard to put your finger on one. Or maybe if you want to talk about, you know, two or three places that you really enjoyed.
Yeah. Again, you know, there's lots of great memories. A lot of them seem much better when you actually sort of years past it, and then you're looking back. But, you know, places like the Eclipse in Coventry was great.
I used to go there every weekend.
Did you?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Wow. Oh, yeah. Club Kinetic up in Stoke, you know, London, things like Telepathy. There were so many underground clubs in London. Obviously, the Rain Dance, my brother started Rain Dance and sort of created Rain Dance. So that was a huge one for me.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, he started it with a couple of partners. He ended up leaving by his last party with them was New Year's Eve 91 into 92 up in Leicester, which they sold out, and then he did one and went off and actually created the aquarium. A load of other stuff later on. Yeah, he's a bit of a club. My older brother.
So Matt, you said earlier that the memories now almost seem better than what was happening at the time. Is that because at
they
the time
always do, don't they?
Yeah. Was it quite challenging at the time? Is that why? Or
No. I think we just sort of delete a lot of the shit parts, don't we? Or if it's a really bad memory, we delete all the good bits.
No,
I mean, you know, at the time it was like, wow, this is all sort of new and different and actually really, really good. But then looking back at things like the Eclipse in Coventry, although it was a, you know, you get behind the DJ box, it was a bit of a shithole, and you're dealing with gangsters on the door and all that sort of thing. But then looking back at it, you think, fuck me, that was such a bit of history. You know, and when you're looking back, you're thinking, I'm so glad that I went through that and, you know, was part of all what happened.
Yeah.
You know, and the parties were amazing. There's no doubt about that at all.
At the time when you started out, it was like You Guys, Shut Up and Dance, a few others who were just pushing the boundaries of production, of the way people even perceived the way music could be heard. Did you ever think about that at the time? Was there always a thing of like, can we do something different? Can we push it forward? Or was you just doing it off instinct?
Yeah, but do you know what? It was like that UK culture at the time, wasn't
yeah.
it? So I think a lot of us, especially around my age, we went through that thing from mid-80s sort of soul music, and then towards the end of the 80s, we were getting into this big rare groove explosion.
Oh, wicked.
Which was breakbeat and stuff. I remember we used to go up to the Wake Club, and that was like the new sort of thing after going to the glitzy, sort of ritzy soul commercial places with it. We were then going to the Wake, listening to Rare Groove, and then DJing really started coming along from sort of 87, 88, scratch DJs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
People like Chad Jackson and CJ McIntosh were winning the DMC competitions. That you had, was it Dave Durrell did the Mars thing, and that whole sort of movement sort of then moved into a sort of gelled with the rave thing. So it was hip hop, this UK sort of mashup thing, then gelled with the acid house thing, and it was just like a coming together of all the different sort of underground cultures that were in London, I suppose around the country as well.
Yeah,
of course, Manchester was big on the acid house thing and stuff as well.
Absolutely.
But it was like a unique sort of coming together of all these sort of different things that were going on at the time. And so as rave sort of evolved quickly through sort of 89 into 90, we were mashing up, you know, our favourite beats from the from these hip hop tracks, mixing it with acid house and whatever else we could find at the time, you know, bleeps and bass and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was a London, for me, it was a London thing. And I think even New York sort of took a lot of influence from what we were doing over here.
Yeah.
That there was a strong kind of dancehall reggae influence that came through particularly for you. I mean, On a Ragga Tip is an obvious example.
Yeah. Way in My Brain as well.
Way in My Brain as well, yeah. So what was that because you were listening to a lot of that, or was that just a moment in time for you, or...?
Yeah, I mean, for me alone, that was probably more me, actually. I was like the odd one out. I was like this sort of white kid in Walthamstow going to the reggae shop at like 12 years old. Going to the
really?
Reggae shop every week, spending my pocket money on 12-inch reggae sort of records and stuff. I was listening to Rodigan every week throughout my sort of early teens into my mid-teens. So I was a real reggae head from Essex, sort of East London border Essex.
I love the fact that you said that was so unique.
Yeah. I really, really wanted to add some reggae into it. So Way of My Brain come about, we was just like, right, yeah, you know, Under Me Sling Team, one of the biggest sort of reggae rhythms of the mid-80s.
And Matt,
we just had to incorporate it, yeah.
Way in My Brain, without sort of blowing smoke, but this is the whole show, so I think we're allowed to blow smoke. I mean, we've definitely played it. I think we might have even played it twice. We've only done about five shows.
Yep.
I adore it. I'm slightly younger than Scott and Cindy here, and the reason I'm saying it is these were the first records that I bought, but these were the first shows that the first going out and the first rave. So I missed out, but these were the records my little 14-year-old self was sort of buying, 15-year-old. Tell me, though, about that transition moment, because one minute, as you say, you know, Essex or, you know, even younger than that and that era, the next thing you know, you're on Top of the Pops and it's gone bananas. Tell us a bit about what that felt like.
It was absolutely mental. I mean, we were destined to make some music. I was recording bits and pieces from a very early age, and then me and Lyme were at school together, and we were the two in the class that were into the music. We used to bring tapes in and play them and stuff. But so we were sort of destined to make music, but we were just a couple of working class lads from Loughton in Essex. And we took it upon ourselves to go to the studio, get the first record out in 89, just an acid house track. But then with the whole rain dance thing, we were doing bits and pieces all the way through. But with the rain dance thing going on, we got really, really inspired again in 91, and made DJs Take Control and Wham a Brain as a white label.
Did you know how good they were when you made them?
No, we knew exactly what we wanted. I remember getting a white label, playing it at rain dance, and thinking, "Yeah, we've done exactly what we wanted to do, what we wanted it to do." And then the phone just didn't stop ringing. It was like, "What the fuck?" Got all these kind of like XL Records, Walk Records, all these different labels phoning us, and it was just like, "This isn't what we were planning." We had no sort of goal of you know, having huge hit records or anything. It was just, we just wanted to make music, and you know, the excitement was going and cutting a record and cutting a dub and putting a white label out. And now we had all these record labels after us. So then as soon as it got released, that was it, top of the pops. We went straight in at 26 or something. I think the second week we was number 11, and we got the call from Top of the Pops. It wasn't even a dream come true, because we wasn't even dreaming it, but because we'd never even got that far to dream that it was a dream come true, but we'd never even dreamt it. It was just so unexpected. It was madness.
So did it become, and I know a lot of people when they talk about some of those hits, in inverted commas, they talk about it, it almost becomes like a millstone around your neck or a poison chalice to something to either repeat or that people have heard so much of it. Was that true with you, or was that, no, that's an absolute belter, we love the fact that that's gone absolutely stellar and everyone knows it?
It was a belter. We ended up going through loads of PAs everywhere, getting really, really drunk and fucking about and DJing everywhere, and that. It was great. We did the follow-up, which it was Changing Tracks was meant to be our main track, which was a follow-up from DJs Take Control with the sort of Chicago-y sort of sound made British. And Wham a Brain and On a Ragged Tip was sort of the follow-up to Wham a Brain, which was a double A side, which actually was probably just as popular, certainly as popular underground. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we presented them to Nick Hawks at XL, and he sort of was sort of all sort of in an R in thinking, you know, and me and John were sort of, I think John said, Lime said it first. He's like, "Do you know what?" He said, "I think Ragged Tip's probably the better tune." So we went to XL and chatted with Nick, and Nick was like, "Actually, do you know what, lads? I think it probably is. Let's just go with it." And we went with it, and again, you know, we went straight in at, I think, number nine or wow. something, yes. And then to number three, and then number two, and then we had a midweek of number one at one point.
Wow.
And it was just like, wow, what on earth's going on? What have we done?
I remember in them days, all the DJs, we were based in Manchester, and all the DJs were just crowning it to playing it, because there was a thing about, it came out so quick and it got into the chart so quick, it was like you had to play it as many times as you could before it became a pop hit. Do you know what I mean? Because you wouldn't play pop. So it was just like everyone, you know, like usually you'd have like 10 man DJing, and if someone played the song, they wouldn't play it straight after. Everyone was like, "Oh, fuck it, let's play it, rewind.
Anyway, fuck right. Yeah. I mean, that was it got released end of April 92, so that was like right in the peak of that 92 rave things, you know what I mean, when everything was just like, you know, anything that was really, really sort of big was charting at some position. I think we were in the top 10 same time as Alternate and a couple of others as well.
Can you tell how into it we are? We're all fighting for questions. This is quite sweet and really happy. I'm going to ask a last one, then perhaps one more from each, and then we'll let you actually go and enjoy your evening. When you mentioned DJs Take Control, again, what a bloody record, like ridiculous. Yeah. And I was saying that as well. I've got a friend here, Scott, you know, we're all great mates. Like, we play it now, and we certainly played it at places like Ibiza after parties in villas in the last decade. It does not sound in the slightest bit out of place. On the contrary, it's a record to put down. Like, did you know that at the time? And how do you feel now about that? Is it nostalgic, or is it like, no, that stands the test of time? How do you feel about records like that?
It's quite a simple tune, really. It is nice. Like, I really do appreciate everything that we've done, and you know, it does mean a lot to me. But we thought the thinking behind it was, right, we've got this hip hop beat from Dope on Plastic, the original was called, and it was raw as fuck. It was like crackly and everything, so we just wanted to get the idea was a really raw breakbeat, the most euphoric sort of breakdown, and that landlord sort of piano, hard hitting piano in it. We put it together, and it just did exactly what we wanted it to do. I mean, like I said, we played it at Rain Dance and it worked. We played it at Rain Dance, I think, a month after, and it had just caught on, and the place fucking erupted.
Oh man,
absolutely erupted, and we just thought, wow. We've done it, and it's caught on. But yeah, no, it has stood the test of time. We were very fussy with production and that, although it's very simple. We did it in a good studio, and I still am very, very particular and fussy with our sort of method of production and quality wise and stuff like that. So yeah, stood test of time. Even XL, actually, we re-released it a couple of years ago with a couple of remixes, and XL was sort of very protective over it as well. Which we found, although it was like, okay, yeah, fair enough. We found it sort of quite nice, really, that they are so a label as big as XL are so sort of protective over that track was sort of meant a lot to us as well.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, those guys are the real still musos, aren't they? Do you know what I mean? They're still...
In the book, like, I've literally been reading the book recently. You're all referenced in it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just one question, just more about sort of end of 92, 93, when there was that shift and that split where I suppose it sort of moved... more darker, which became sort of jungle drum and bass as it moved on to, and then I suppose the other side went more happy hardcore. What was your feeling on that? Because was it noticeable? Was there like a shift where certain records or certain producers who you would play, you just stopped playing because they went one way, or was it like a gradual thing where before you knew it, there was two different scenes?
It was a huge shift over quite a short period of time, really. So throughout 92, the tempo of the music went from sort of 130-ish right the way up to sort of 160-ish and beyond. And you're right, yeah, it went sort of dark. It went from being really sort of happy, piano-y, and hardcore as well.
Yeah.
Sort of driving. Sort of hard style to sort of dark and gloomy sort of sounds, and then I suppose the other side of it, you wouldn't call jungle music dark, but the jungle sort of side of it without the sort of 4/4 beat, some more of a sort of two-step beat sort of thing. Yeah. But I was sort of in the thick of all of it, really. So I was playing a whole lot of mixing it all up.
Yeah.
I was certain. Sort of areas I was just as well known for playing jungle as I was hardcore. I used to do a jungle show on Kiss in London now and again and stuff as well, but I did end up taking that hardcore route eventually, because I think it was probably around some point in about 94 where it gradually split and split and split. So for a while in 93, a lot of the raves, the big raves like Unite Dance and Dreamscape and Skelters and things like that were sort of mixing it up between sort of hardcore and the jungle and dark side stuff, intelligent drummer bass or whatever they called it.
Yeah.
But it did gradually sort of separate out, and it got to a point where I had to sort of make a choice, really. Doing a set of everything wasn't working. It got to that point, so I went down the hardcore route, but then still carried on doing a bit of drum and bass sort of here and there, which I've always loved and still do. So yeah, a bit of a strange old time, really. But then around sort of 95 and stuff, I was playing a lot of house music again as well, and then by 96 I was in Ibiza sort of most weeks right the way through till now. So
that golden age then.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Matt, given your long and incredible history, I know it's really hard to pick a favourite tune from the era, but I understand that you have. But before we play it, I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about, well, first of all, say what the tune is, and then just tell us a little bit about why you like it so much.
I think this tune, it's one of those tunes. It's by a band that are, you know, bigger than, just as big as the whole Raging itself. But it's one of those tunes you can drop it right from the beginning, and it just goes off the first note. Even I think people would even recognise the first note of it, and it will immediately get a reaction. It's just an incredible anthem, and actually still underground, so it was never actually a chart hit or anything like that. It's just an incredible, emotional, fun, hands in the air, hardcore, bit of everything, breakbeat. It's just got everything there, and it just encompasses the whole sort of rave thing. It just encompasses rave in a 6-minute track. Everything you want from the early 90s.
Perfectly put.
I've obviously played it over and over and over and over over the years, because it's certainly a dance floor filler, but credible and amazing at the same time.
Fantastic. Thanks.
Can't say more than that, really.
Matt, thanks so much for being on the show. We're going to play your tune now, which is Your Love by The Prodigy.
Thank you, Matt.
This has been awesome.
Thank you. Salute you.
We'll
finishing on a stone cold classic right there. Not sure there's much more we can say about that. What a tune. So this has been terrific fun. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as we've enjoyed making it. This is Pipe and Slipmat signing off. We'll see you hopefully sooner than 18 months' time for the next instalment. Thanks for listening. Bye.